Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to take up today Leviticus chapter 26, verses 1 through 13, the first part of chapter 26. The whole chapter talks about blessings and cursings. Verses 1 through 13 considers blessings for keeping the law, and verses 14 through 46 discusses curses for breaking the law. So the blessings are 13 verses long, and the curses are 23 verses long, and the NIV Study Bible points out the curses are longer than the blessings. And that sort of fits in the theme that the law is more punishment, but lack of punishment is also blessing. And there's going to be affirmative blessings here in the first 13 verses. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Leviticus 25, we talked about the first part of the chapter of the Sabbath years, the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. That was two audios ago. And then the last part of chapter 25, we talked about laws of redemption, redeeming oneself if one gets in slavery, redeeming land if one loses it, sells it for debt, and so forth. So now we start in Leviticus 26, verses 1 and 2. You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it. For I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Now, the general statement here in verse 1, you shall not make for yourselves idols, he fleshes out of the next part of verse 1 by mentioning image, sacred pillars, and figured stones. These are just different kinds of idols. We'll get to those in a minute, but first, let's point out that this was a prohibition against making idols. It was not a prohibition against making statues, and sometimes I think of English ecclesiastical history. The Puritans got a little bit carried away by smashing statues that were not necessarily being used for idols. Nothing wrong with having a statue. As the NIV note says, this was a prohibition against making statues for idolatrous purposes. Why is the law against idolatry mentioned here? Because it's a fundamental law. In other words, you want to get blessed? Don't worship idols. First part of the chapter, last part of the chapter, you want to get cursed? Worship an idol. A breach of the law against idolatry would lead to a breach of all the other laws. And that's true. Look at America's rejection of God and notice that every other law known to decent mankind, laws of sexuality, laws of morality, lying, cheating, stealing, the basic Ten Commandments type of laws, they're being broken right and left. So let's look at some examples of these idols that were to be eschewed by the Israelites. You don't set up for yourselves an image. Here's how Gill describes an image. Quote, any likeness of man or beast cut out of wood or stone and may include any molten image of gold, silver, or brass, and then engraven with a tool as the golden calf was. That just means an image of something means a copy of something. It could be a beast. It could be a cow. It could be a man. It could be a fly. It could be a fish like Dagon. So you don't do that. It could be a golden bull like the golden calf worship of northern Israel later in Israel's history. Another thing you don't set up is a sacred pillar. John Gill says that's a heap of rude stones not made in any likeness. It was just a pile of rocks that people worshipped. Next, you shall not place a figured stone in your land. The NIV has a carved stone. John Gill says this figured stone, the figure that's in the stone, may have references to idolatrous engravings carved into a rock. That sounds reasonable. A figured stone, a stone that has figures in it. Presumably that rock was not shaped into a likeness, because if it were shaped into a likeness, that would fall under the category of image, which has already been mentioned, but this is a carving out of a stone so that people could worship it. So these are all general forms of idolatry. None of it is allowed, of course. Verse 2, you shall keep my Sabbaths. That's another fundamental law. Verse 1 is no idols. Number 2, negatively, no idols. Number 2, positively, affirmatively, you keep God's Sabbaths. Now, Sabbaths, of course, could be the seventh day Sabbath every Saturday. It could be the seventh year Sabbaths when the fields laid fallow. Or it could be the festival Sabbaths, the high Sabbath, that happened during, for example, the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles or the first and last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Those were festival Sabbaths. And I'm sure it's all of the above. Any Sabbath, you keep them. And you reverence my sanctuary. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, very frequently in this book of the law, the Sabbath and the sanctuary are mentioned as antidotes to idolatry. It's an interesting point. Keep the Sabbath, honor the sanctuary, reverence the sanctuary. God spent a lot of time telling Moses how to build that sanctuary and how to ordain the priest in that sanctuary and how to set up the furniture in that sanctuary and how to keep the feast at that sanctuary. So do what God says. I am Yahweh. I am the Lord. I am is the Yahweh means I am, or a form of I am. His existence is the same thing as his essence. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. In other words, this is the reason that you're supposed to obey all the laws I'm giving you, is because I'm Yahweh. It's just like when your mama tells you not to put your hand in the cookie cutter and you're 2 years old and an idiot and you say, why not? And the mother realizes you're too dumb to know why you're not supposed to put the hand in the cookie jar. So she just says, I'm your mother. That's why. Well, that's kind of what God's doing to the Israelites. You obey me. Why? Because I am the Lord. I don't need to give you a reason why you're supposed to obey me. You obey me because I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. I am the Lord your God. He says that in verse 1, for I am the Lord your God. He says it in verse 2, I am the Lord. Says it twice. We go now to verses 3 and 4 in Leviticus 26. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Now, keeping the commandments, that was the key to get blessed. Obedience is the key to blessing, as the NIV Study Bible puts it. Now, here's some interesting New Testament scriptures about keeping God's laws and getting blessed thereby. Galatians 6, 7 through 10. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. Sowing to your flesh, you know, ingesting alcohol and foreign substances, drugs into your body, and so forth. That's for an example. You're going to reap corruption from that. Your flesh is going to die from that. But the one who sows to the Spirit will reap from the Spirit eternal life. Sowing to the Spirit. Oh, I want to cultivate love, joy, peace, gentleness, long-suffering. And the result of all that, the harvest of all that sowing to the Spirit is eternal life. Again, you obey God's laws, you get blessed. Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. Sure, you don't get blessed as soon as you want to get blessed. You have to wait for the harvest, but the harvest is eternal life. And if you wait until then, if you don't grow weary, you keep on enduring, you're going to reap the fruit of the Spirit, eternal life. Verse 10, so then while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially to those who are of the household of the faith. Always do good to people, and you're going to get blessed. Now, this is not works righteousness. There's nothing in the doctrine of justification by grace alone through faith. There's nothing in there that says that good works do not result from that justification. In fact, the scripture is full of verses saying that we're saved unto good works. And this is an example of one right here. How about this? James 1:25. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does. You abide in the law and you get blessed. Now, there's a question of what law of liberty is there. I'm assuming that's the law of Christ, because the Mosaic law, I mean, if you're in the Old Testament, there was stuff about if you obey the law, you get blessed. But also, Paul had a lot of stuff about you can't obey the law, and as a result, you're cursed by it. So I'm assuming that James here is talking about the perfect law is the law of Christ. So you obey Christ's commands, you abide in his law, and you're going to get blessed. And I can tell you, any Christian will tell you that despite how hard this life is, despite how hard the events of one's life are, every Christian will say, thank God he has blessed me so much. So obedience is the key to blessing. Now, these first 13 verses of Leviticus 26 are similar to Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28 is a famous blessings and cursings chapter. It's just like Leviticus 26. Now, in Deuteronomy 28, the first 14 verses give the blessings for obedience, and verses 15, Deuteronomy 8, 15 to the end of chapter 28, and then all the way the first 28 verses of chapter 29 give the cursings for disobedience. Now, the NIV Study Bible says, notice here how the list of cursings is longer in both passages. That's human nature. We react to fear of punishment much better than we do with promises of reward. The stick has more of a noticeable effect on us than the carrot. Now, I said that keeping the law, or God said in verse 3, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments, then I will give you rains and produce and blessings and so forth. That cannot mean perfect obedience. No, only one man ever kept the law perfectly is Jesus. So if the law meant perfect obedience, then it would say this. If you walk in my statutes and keep perfectly my commandments and do not commit one single sin, then I'll give you rains. Otherwise, I'm going to curse you. Well, then that means this will have been cursed forever, because nobody can keep the statutes completely. But just as a general rule, in fact, I even believe this applies to these people were not believers. Most of the Israelites were not even Christians. Of course, they weren't Christians, but a lot of them didn't even believe in Yahweh. But, you know, how many people do you know that don't commit adultery and get blessed by that? They don't get a jealous husband, the husband of the adulteress coming in to shoot you, the one who has committed adultery. That doesn't happen. You don't have divorce lawyers and lack of money, kids' broken hearts and all the hell, the sexual diseases, all the hell that comes to you from sexual disobedience. Non-Christians can experience that lack of hell by just keeping the law. Don't commit adultery. That doesn't mean the non-Christian is perfect. Of course not. He's not forensically justified in heaven. If he dies, he's going to go to hell. But it means that he's not going to suffer a shotgun put in his face by his angry wife. So this just means keeping your commandments as best you know how, generally. Now, if the Israelites would do that in verse 4, then I would give you rains in their season. Now, we're going to talk about the Jewish agricultural year. Rains seldom fell in Judea, actually, because Judea is sort of a deserty type place. But there were two seasons, and when it did, the former rain and the latter rain, of which I'm sure you've heard. The former rain usually occurs October/November, end of October, beginning of November, the month of Cheshvan, if I've said that right. I hope I did. Now, when the former rain comes, plowing is done. The Israelites would not plow until the former rain fell. That would soften up the ground, then they would plow. And then they would plant after they plow. So the plowing and planting was done in the autumn, which to me is, I'm not a farmer, but you plant right before winter. That seems kind of strange. But the seeds stayed in the ground during the winter months, and winter, I'm sure, was pretty mild in Israel. And then, and this is both wheat and barley, and then both the barley and wheat matured and started growing in the spring. Barley matured faster. It was finished reaping right around the time of Passover. Passover, which is Nisan 14. Then the next 7 days after that was Feast of Unleavened Bread, the second day of which they had the offering of the first fruit of the barley harvest. So somewhere in March or April, somewhere around there, early spring, let's say, Nisan, the barley crop would come, and then shortly thereafter, about a month, 50 days later, the offering of the first fruits. This is late spring, maybe early summer, May, June, somewhere around there. The wheat has all been harvested, most of it, by Sivan the 6th, I think it is, which is the day of Pentecost. So you got the barley and the wheat harvest coming up in barley in early spring, and the wheat harvest coming out in late spring. Now, of course, these dates are not precise because a lot of the timing of the planting and harvest depended on when the rains came, and they didn't come like clockwork. Sometimes they were later, and sometimes they were earlier. These are just general dates, general times. We go now to Leviticus 26, verse 5. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. All right, the threshing, that would be the threshing of the harvest of barley and wheat. I said they were all harvested by late spring, early summer, May, June, say late May. Well, now the wheat and the barley's got to be threshed, got to get rid of all the chaff. And when the threshing was done, then the grape gathered. Then they would gather the grapes from the vineyard, and that was done usually in June or July. So all the harvest, all the grain is harvested, barley and wheat, and now the grapes are gathered in June. Gil says July. Another website I have says June. In the summer, middle summer. Now, the summer harvest involved more than just grapes. Only grapes are mentioned here in Leviticus, but here's a quote from a website about Jewish festivals. Quote, after Pentecost, and of course that's 6th Sivan right there in early summer, most of the harvest was fruit. So we're talking about in the summer harvest. Most of the harvest was fruit. Grapes, olives, dates, figs, pomegranates, and numerous fruits, seeds, and vegetables of lesser importance. In other words, everything came in during the summer. Now, the grapes came in the middle of the summer, and the grape gathering would go on all the way until sowing time. So that was, sowing time was usually in October, as Gil and Clark say, as my website here, gci.org, whatever that stands for, I forgot. Barley and wheat were planted in the autumn and ripened in the spring. So basically we get right around to fall again and wait for the early rains again. Of course, they don't sow, of course, until the early rains rained, and then they sowed. So there's your whole cycle. And basically the law is saying all the way through the cycle you're going to have results. You're going to have crops growing. You're going to have grapes growing. You will thus eat your food to the full and leave securely in the land. Why? Because you kept the law. Not all evil in this world is done by failing to obey God's commands, but the great majority of it is. Some of the evil that comes in the world is just because we live in a fallen world. Like Job, he experienced things even though he was keeping the law. But in general, you keep the law unless God has destined you for a period of trial through no fault of your own. But generally, you can avoid a lot of trouble by keeping his law. To the full you shall eat, verse 5 says. To the full. This recalls a verse in Amos 9:13. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him who sows seed, when the mountains will drip sweet wine, and all the hills will be dissolved. I guess what Amos means when he says the hills will be dissolved is so much wine is running out of the grapes that you look up at the hill and it looks like it's dissolved in a shimmering mass of wine. I think that's what he means. But when he says the plowman will overtake the reaper, what it means is the reaper from the previous harvest, harvesting in early and late spring, he's going to be working so hard, the reaper is, he's going to be reaping so much barley and so much wheat, he won't finish in time. He won't finish reaping, and by the time the next autumn rolls around, when the early rains come and the plowing begins, the plowman is going to say, hey, reaper, get out of the way, get your old crops out of the way, I'm getting ready to plant the new crops, you got too much. The treader of grapes will overtake him who sows seed. You sow the seeds for the grapes. You come around, the grapes grow. The grapes grow, and then people start picking the grapes. And by golly, it's time to plant more seeds the next year for grapes. And the old grapes are still being picked, and they're in the way. Just a poetic way of saying, man, you're going to be blessed. Now, this also shows how God is able to make the land produce food. I love reading these stories, like in Africa. There's a couple of... One's an American guy that went down there and is teaching people in Sierra Leone, Malawi, and other places down there in Africa how to do scientific agriculture. And they're turning the desert into a paradise. And another African guy who ended up being a big shot oil executive, he abandoned as a child in abject poverty in Kenya, ends up becoming a very rich guy, had his big house down there, and then God got a hold of him, and he says, okay, I'm going to give it all to the ministry, and he started planting stuff, and he planted so many trees in his hometown outside of Nairobi, Kenya, his name is Mully, M-U-L-L-Y, that it actually changed the climate, the trees started putting so much moisture in the air. Well, you know, that's the sort of stuff God is able to do that with the world, even though the world has been cursed by our sin, it is still able to produce lots of stuff if we understand how to do it and if we obey his laws. By the way, Mully, you can see that on Vudu, the movie about his life, which is incredible, for free. You can also pay some money for it and see it on YouTube. And you will live securely in your land. That means no foreign enemies will come in and bust you if you obey the law. Leviticus 26:6-8. I shall also grant peace in the land so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword will pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. This illustrates that it's not necessarily how many people in your army that is going to cause you to win. I've been reading a lot of ancient and medieval history, and I'm telling you, there's lots of times. I think the Battle of Crecy and the Hundred Years' War, the English were outnumbered terribly, and they whopped. I mean, they whopped the French, if I believe I'm correct about that. There's lots of other examples of that, too. And so God is telling the Israelites, it doesn't matter how many people come attack you. If you're outnumbered, you're gonna whack them. This idea of one chasing 1,000, the minority beating the majority in warfare, was actually used against Israel in Deuteronomy 32:30. How could one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight unless the rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? In other words, this is the opposite. If the Israelites are way in the majority, they're still going to lose if the Lord gives them up. So again, the idea is keep the commandments. Not only will you have plenty to eat, but there's not going to be any foreign nations coming into your country and stealing all the stuff that you plant. So you won't have to be like Gideon and hide the crops. Of course, by the time of Gideon, the Israelites had not kept the law. The whole history of Israel is a time of not keeping the law, and that's why the whole history of Israel is a history of tragedy and trouble, because they didn't keep the law. One minor point here. Verse 6, I shall also grant peace in the land. That's Eretz, translated into Greek as gay. That word is a great word because it shows up in so many theological contexts, theological controversies, like in Revelation. If you translate gay in Revelation as land instead of earth, instead of getting a worldwide conflict, you get judgment on the land of Israel, which I believe is the way it should properly be interpreted. But unfortunately, the modern translations don't do that. Well, most of the translations, they just assume it's the whole world. You can't assume that. Well, here, Eretz, the Hebrew word that's translated gay, is translated as land. It refers to the land of Israel because it obviously you tell by context, and here the context is obviously Israel. And so the land of Israel is what's referred to by Eretz, as John Gill says. We go now to Leviticus 26, 9 through 13, and we'll finish up this audio. So I will turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves, and I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. I will make you fruitful and multiply if you keep my commandment. That's the earlier stated condition that carries forth here through these verses. Now this promise to make the Israelites to be fruitful and to multiply is a repeat of what God said in Genesis 1:22. God blessed them, talking to Adam and Eve, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth." Genesis 1:28, God blessed them, Adam and Eve, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and over the lands of the sky." Now there, Eretz is earth because he's talking about Adam and Eve, which is not Israel yet. Now, the opposite of being fruitful and multiply is losing your children. That's in the curses part of the last part of the chapter, which we'll take up next week. Leviticus 26:22. I will let loose among you the beast of the field, which will bereave you of your children. The opposite of being fruitful and multiply. Now, it's interesting. Even though Israel was under slavery in Egypt, they increased. You recall that the Pharaoh got worried about it. There were so many Israelites running around. That's why he got the Hebrew midwives. He asked them to kill the firstborn of the Israelite slaves, which they didn't do, thank God. But the Israelites were being fruitful and multiplied even while they were in slavery. So God says he will be fruitful and multiply you if you obey his commandments, verse 9, and I will confirm my covenant with you. Now, which covenant is that? Well, there's two options. It could be the Abrahamic covenant, the famous one in Genesis 15:5, and he took him outside, took Abraham, and he, God, took Abraham outside and said, "Now look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them." And he said to them, "So shall your descendants be." And there's the idea of being fruitful and multiply. So it sounds like that's what he's talking about in the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant always speaks a lot of descendants, land, offspring, and blessing. The offspring part of the Abrahamic promises is the descendants. And to make that come about, then God had to make the descendants fruitful and multiply. And he did. But here, they're fruitful and multiply if they obey the commandments, if they obey the covenant. Now, that Abrahamic covenant was unconditional, of course, because the descendants were more than physical descendants. As Father Abraham, all of us, I am one of them, a Gentile. All of us are sons of Father Abraham, as Paul says in Romans 4, I think it is. So Abraham's descendants ended up being spiritual descendants too. But the physical part of that promise was promised. It was conditional, though. You had to obey the law. And unfortunately, the Israelites didn't do that. The covenant that God will confirm with the Israelites could be the Mosaic covenant made at Mount Sinai. Now, favoring that is the fact that this law itself is being given at Mount Sinai, the law of Leviticus. God is speaking to Moses at the door of the tent of the tabernacle, which is right below Mount Sinai at this stage of the peace. And so that makes it sound like it's the Mosaic covenant. Well, it doesn't really matter. The Mosaic covenant is an extension of the Abrahamic covenant. So whichever covenant is being talked about here, God's going to bless it if you obey his law. Verse 10, God says, "You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new." Let me give you a different translation of that. That's the NASB. Here's the Holman Christian Study Bible. "You will eat the old grain of the previous year and will clear out the old to make room for the new." And that's the idea. You got so much grain, there's plenty of it left over. Oh my gosh, we don't have room for all the new crop that just came in. We got too much. Nice problem to have, is it not? I guess they could take it out, the old grain, and feed it to the horses. Verse 11, God says, Yahweh says, "I will make my dwelling among you." My dwelling among you. This is an old theme. How does God live among the Israelites? Because he lived in the tabernacle. Where in the tabernacle did he live? Which room? The back room. The 10 by 10 by 10 Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and the two cherubim were propped up at the, were springing up from the edges of the mercy seat. The Shekinah glory appeared between those two cherubim, and in the Ark of the Covenant was the law, the tablets of the law, as well as Aaron's rod, which budded, as well as some manna, but basically the law. So that's where God lived. So he lived among the people. He made his dwelling among the Israelites. The NIV note says that another way to translate that is saying, instead of saying dwelling, I will make my dwelling among you. The NIV note says it could be translated, I will make my tabernacle among you, which makes it even clearer. A tabernacle is a tent where God lives, which is what he was doing. But you want to make the Shekinah glory disappear and me to leave my dwelling amongst you Israelites? Disobey my law. Otherwise, if you obey my law, verse 12, I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. And everybody will know, this is Yahweh, these are my people. Leave them alone. Now, this idea of God living amongst his Israelites, that could be God lives with the Israelites in a general sense, but I don't think so, as I just said. I think it means he's living with the Israelites particularly, especially in the tabernacle. Now, this idea of God dwelling among his people, we can see that in 2 Samuel 7:6. For I have not dwelt in a house since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent, even in a tabernacle. Now, of course, God, the omnipresent God, is everywhere, but as far as his presence among his people, it was in the tabernacle, in the tent. Now, this idea of God living in the tent among his people is mentioned by Paul in 2 Corinthians 6:16, last part of the verse. For we are the temple of the living God, just as God said. And what is a temple, by the way? A temple is a place where God lives. So God lives amongst Christians. For we, Christians, are the temple of the living God, just as God said, I will dwell in them. So Paul is quoting our verse here. I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. That idea is also in Exodus 29:45, Jeremiah 31:1, and Ezekiel 37:27, three other places besides our verse here in 26:12 of Leviticus. So it's a big idea. It's all through the old scriptures. God lives among his people, and by golly, God lives amongst his church. And when you look at the church today, the bare ruined choirs of the church, the apostasy of the church, the liberalism of the church, the wokeness of the church, the bureaucracy of the church, the institutionalism of the church, the sexual immorality of the church, and all that stuff. Remember, God lives among us, and therefore we should be holy even as he is holy. Now, verse 13 says that if you keep my commandments, the implied condition of keeping the commandments is still in effect here in verse 13. If you keep my commandments, I will be the Lord your God. He says in verse 12, I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. And then verse 13, he says, I am the Lord your God. I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves. Now he's going back and telling them what he's done for them in the past, and so he's using that as a sort of a guarantee of what he's going to do in the future if they keep his commandments. He says, look, I broke the bars of your yoke. Yoke meaning something, the constraint that's put around a slave's neck, and I made you walk erect. If you're walking around with a yoke, you're not walking erect. You're walking around like a slave with your head bowed down, looking at the ground. That's the way slaves walk. But he says, look, I made you walk erect as a free man, as free men, and I'll do it again. I'll bless you. Now remember, these are people who are just out of slavery. They're being chased by pagan armies, first by the Egyptians. The Amalekites just fought a big battle right before all this happened at Mount Sinai. They're still in the middle of the desert. They're facing a land which they don't know exactly what's up there, but they're going to find out later. They're full of giants. They're not exactly in the most secure position in the world, but God gives them all these blessings, and all they got to do is just listen to him, obey him, listen to his words. I like the Chinese word for obey. It's tinghua. Ting means listen, and hua means word. Listen to the words of your parents. Listen to the words. Listen to the words of Yahweh. And you're going to be okay. You're going to be more than okay. You're going to be blessed abundantly. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with the good news. The bad news is next week. I hope you stay tuned for that, and we'll see what happens when the Israelites do not carry out the law. So stay tuned for the next audio, and I hope you've enjoyed this one.